Hello and welcome to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and
me, Alex Rouget.
I got there in the end. And we've got a great show today. We've got interviews with Gareth Bell-Jones, who's the curator at Wising Arts in Bourne, and romantic novelist Sue Moorcroft. And our studio guest is the wonderful Angela Clark. And she's written a memoir called Confessions of a Fashionista, which throws light on the fashion industry. So, Alex.
Yes.
What books have you read that have thrown light on a particular industry?
Well, I've quite enjoyed sort of dipping in and out of Rupert Everett's Vanished Years. That sort of salacious gossip, but you can kind of, with his book, it is really well written as well. But he's just so bitchy. I mean, it's great. And the insight, I love this bit. There was a bit in it about going to Hollywood party with Madonna. And he has this wonderful phrase where he says, "This party is for 1,000 careful Cinderellas." And so instead of imagining that this is a, you know, exciting Hollywood party that you want to be at, the best party you've ever been to, everybody is there to be seen and then waiting to get their cabs home because they've got to have their beauty sleep. Hardly anyone drinks anything, apart from Rupert, obviously. And it was just... love that kind of little tidbit of something that you didn't realise went on, and also all the other, you know, general dirt he dishes on people. It's fascinating.
He is very waspish, isn't he? I've read that. It's very funny. And it was the kind of book I could give to my mum, actually, because he mentions lots of people she would know, and actually she really liked peeking behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's that feeling of being sort of allowed into areas that you're not usually allowed into. How about you?
Well, political memoirs. I quite like political memoirs, actually. And something like James Nocte's The Rivals or Alistair Campbell's Diaries, I love, because you kind of get under the surface and find out what's really going on. And there's a really good one by Peter Stoddart, which is called 30 Days. He spent 30 days with Tony Blair, actually, in the run-up to the Iraq War. Mm. And it's just fascinating, all the meetings, the confrontations, the boredom sometimes, although there's not a great deal of that. But the bit I remember most of all is when he describes Leo Blair, Tony Blair's son, delivering wagon wheels to all the desks in number 10 Downing Street. So when everybody came to their desk in the morning, there was a wagon wheel, including one on the chair that was reserved for George W. Bush at a meeting. And it's just little things like
details,
that.
Details, yeah.
Yeah, that break it.
That reveal their that they're just like us, and the human side, that's what we really want to know.
Yeah, there's a family there. Mm. So, Angela, you worked in the fashion industry, and I know you wanted to from the beginning of your memoir. Before you actually stepped foot through the door, did you read about it?
That would have been far too sensible. No, the only prep I did to get in was hanging around the magazine shelves and flicking through Vogue beforehand and wondering what it would be like when I magically lost a lot of weight and looked like one of the girls in the pictures. I'm afraid my memoir reading tends to be a lot more depressive than that. I haven't read masses of memoirs. I tend to prefer fiction. But I read A Child Called It, which is
Misery.
I think I read it from underneath the duvet, from which I did not come out again for several days, crying, weeping. But this year I read Damien Barr, Maggie and Me, which is a great memoir of his time growing up in a mining town in Scotland under Maggie Thatcher's reign. And he is gay, so it sort of charts his coming to terms with his own sexuality and also the impact of that on the people around him. It wasn't a terribly judgment-free place, I don't think.
He's actually a guest at Cambridge Wordfest as well, which is happening tomorrow, I think.
He's very charming, and the book is well worth a read.
We've got loads of questions to ask you, but we're going to start with a piece of music first.
Yeah, I don't really need to ask you why you chose this. It's the Kinks' Dedicated Follower of Fashion, which is a great one. Okay, here we go.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town, eagerly pursuing all the latest fads and trends, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes. was a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh, yes, he is.
Oh, yes, he is.
Oh, yes, he is.
Oh, yes, he is.
There's one thing that he loves, and that is flattery. One week he's in polka dots, the next week he's in stripes. But he's a dedicated follower of fashion. They seek him here, they seek him there, in Regent Street and Leicester Square. Everywhere the Carnavician army marches on, each one out. Dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is.
Oh yes he is.
Oh yes he is.
Oh yes he is.
His world is built round discotheques and parties. His pleasure-seeking individual always looks his best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is.
Oh yes he is.
Shop to shop, just like a butterfly. In matters of the cloth, he is as thick as can be, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. He's a dedicated follower of fashion. He's a dedicated follower of fashion.
Hello and welcome back to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 FM, and our studio guest is Angela Clark. Angela Clark is a writer and broadcaster. She's written on fashion, feminism, beauty and shopping for a range of publications, including The Daily Mail, The Independent and The Guardian. Her first book, Confessions of a Fashionista, is a humorous memoir based on her decade working in the fashion industry. It's subtitled The Good, The Bad and The Botox. So first of all, Angela, what is a fashionista?
Ooh. It's a lovely made-up word. For the process of my book, it's somebody that works in the fashion industry and is wholly consumed by the fashion industry, as most people are who are in it. But I suppose in the wider sense, it's anybody who is interested in fashion and embraces it on a daily basis.
And there's the usual disclaimers at the front about some of it's fiction, some of it's true. How much of it is true and how much of it is real? I mean, you leave out, tantalisingly, you leave out names occasionally. Oh, this pop star, that film star.
Yes, I was rather made to do that by, you know, the legal department. but it's actually pretty much all true. The only things that haven't changed, apart from names, are some of the timings of things, and that's so it could be shoehorned into a nice little narrative arc that fitted into a book. So you didn't have 6 months of me going, and then I got up, put on my Spanx, went to work, and then I got up, put on my Spanx, and went to work, because we would all die of boredom then.
Spanx do feature quite a lot in you.
Spanx feature a lot in my life.
So what you changed it for reasons of conciseness, and presumably to protect legally people.
Yes, and also to disguise people's who people are, so that they don't come after me with very sharp pointy high heels.
Yes, stilettos. And when did you write it? You wrote it after you'd actually left the fashion industry.
I did. I wrote it as I was on my way out. I spent about 8 years working, for the most part, in the fashion industry as an agent, repping hair, makeup, stylist, photographers, during which I produced catwalk shows and magazine photo shoots. Either side of that, I did a couple of other things, and it was in one of my jobs either side of that where I started to work and write on the book.
Just going back to the idea of the things that you had to sort of change slightly, all the names, and was there a point when you decided to write the book where you felt a bit nervous and you thought, you know, it is a bit exposing of yourself as well as other people, friends, to write a memoir?
It is very hard to expose yourself and also your friends. I had to ask a lot of favours of people. One or two friends who appear in the book have actually had their name changed at their request, and one or two haven't. Most notably, my best friend Jen, who gets rather a good ribbing all the way through. Luckily, she has a very robust sense of humour, and I think she quite possibly thought it would never get published. It would be fine.
get her to sign that she doesn't mind before.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it is nervous opening yourself up. I always find it deeply amusing what my mum said when she first read it. My mum is not like your archetypal writer's mum who gushes about how wonderful their offspring is and how they're going to win the Booker and all this kind of thing. For a start, she's like, are you sure you want to do this? And then when she did read it, she went, darling, I don't really remember it being that funny when you went through it.
Did you set out to write something that exposed the fashion industry, or was it... Because it does, I mean, your first chapter finds you, you know, knee-deep in a wheelie bin or something, searching for a pricey necklace.
Yeah.
So right at the beginning, we're very aware this isn't going to be all about glamour. You're going to expose an underbelly. Was that what you set out to do?
Well, I set out to write the truth, and I think that is the truth of the fashion industry. Of course, the fashion industry, by its very existence, is great at glamorising itself and making itself look fantastic and shiny and really exciting and really glamorous. But it's run by a lot of very hard-working people, and there are a number of very misshaped large egos that dominate it that can have an effect on your life if you work in it. It is hard, it is dirty. That's life, I suppose.
Are there really people that sniff cake rather than eat it?
Yes.
That is astonishing.
What is the world coming
to? But, well, and actually, you use humour there to make a serious point, actually, about women in the fashion industry and the fashion industry's attitude to women, that these women feel forced to do this, because even though they're not models, they have to stay thin themselves. Again, you use humour there to expose something serious. Was that intentional?
Yeah, I think humour is the best way to shine a light on anything that you want to draw attention to. I quite like making people laugh and then thinking about it afterwards and having them question, actually, should I have really laughed at that? Is that really funny? Isn't that something that we should be worried about? I find it very interesting from the outside of the fashion industry that everybody is very fixated on the size of models. The vast majority of models that I encountered were teen girls of the age of 14 or 15 who happened to be genetically very tall and very thin. When I was 14, I could eat as much McDonald's as I liked, and it made no difference to my size of my hips, and they are in a similar position. What people don't shine a spotlight on is women who aren't 14, and the fashion industry is a great example of that, in the sense that you have a lot of women of many ages, all identical dress size, all tiny, all punishing themselves to get into that, you know, get into that dress size, get into that tick box of how they're supposed to look. And I think it's important to question that more, perhaps, than the models.
I thought that was one of the most heartbreaking things, actually. And as you say, you're laughing at it, but thinking, oh, these poor girls.
Well, that bit right is quite near the beginning, about them being a commodity, and them, that conversation where they come in and the agents are assessing them. Do they hear all that?
Yes.
Where you say bad skin, wrong size hips, they hear that, those
yes.
comments.
Yeah,
that's just dreadful.
Yeah,
and as you say, sometimes off the page, they look quite plain.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose what models need is regular features, and they get in front of a spotlight and get a good makeup artist, and they're just transformed into these beautiful, otherworldly things.
It's quite extraordinary when you see models in the flesh. They do look unusual, they do look striking or head-turning or odd, but not what you would necessarily deem as pretty or recognisably attractive in the sense that we would think of a pretty girl or whatever. But they all have great bone structure, and they have that magic thing of standing in front of the camera and bringing something to life.
Mm.
It's actually quite a tough job.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, you do bring that out, the long fashion shows, the travelling, which does sound very glamorous, but, yeah, because they are pushed around and manipulated. Yeah, they're treated like pieces of
meat. It can't be good. I mean, I wouldn't want my daughter to have to go through that. It just sounds horrific, really.
Well, in the book I talk about the first photo shoot that I went to, which was in August, and it was 32 degrees. We were in a very small heat wave and they were shooting the winter catalogue, because that's when you shoot autumn winter in August, and so you had models in fur coats, earmuffs, all the layers, standing in 32 degree heat, and one of the girls actually passed out because it was so hot. On the flip side of that, when it's very, very, very cold, you are shooting spring, summer, and you're outside in weather like it is today, chilly, in a bikini, in high heels, and you have to make it look like it's real. It's very physically difficult to pose as well for long periods of time. I know that sounds like a lighthearted thing to say. Everybody thinks, oh yeah, you just stand there and put your hand on your hip. So difficult. But actually, if you've tried to hold a position for a number of hours on a rock that's wet and minus 2 degrees in a bikini, yeah, then you begin to think, oh, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
You know, and what the girls don't tend to do largely is eat during the day either, because they might have a bloated tummy or whatever, or things like that, or there's too much time pressure. It's physically trying, I think, very difficult, and mentally the judgment.
Yeah.
That
it's
you
gonna,
can get.
It's going to wear away at you, isn't it? Well, it is fascinating stuff. There's also a wonderful love story in the book as well, which brings me nicely to my to the guest that I interviewed earlier in the week, which is the romantic novelist Sue Moorcroft. Her latest novel is called Is This Love? And I asked her what it was about.
It's called Is This Love? It's from my the same publisher I've been with. This is my sixth book with them, Chocolate. And it's about Tamara, who doesn't leave the village where she was brought up because of her sister. Her sister Liddy is an adult who needs more care than most adults. And Tamara feels not so much responsible for her, but she just couldn't bear to leave her because it would make her sister so sad. So she stays in the village. She's a yoga teacher. Her sister Liddy was brain injured, unfortunately, in a hit and run accident. And Jed Cassius comes back to the village at the beginning of the book to explain who was driving the car that hit Liddy. So it's a story about the different qualities of love, because love is more than just romantic love. We have love for our siblings and our parents. Always, that doesn't always go quite according to plan. It isn't straightforward. And how far you'd go for somebody. At the beginning of the book, Tamara has a long-term boyfriend, Max, who's kind of a best friend kind of boyfriend rather than a really passionate love kind of boyfriend. And he gets offered a fantastic job in publishing and wants her to move, and she just flatly refuses, which defines for her relationship that A, he asked her to leave Liddy, and B, he expected her to, and C, she wasn't going to. So that sorted that relationship out just really in time for Jed to come
on the scene.
And Tamara had a crush on him when she was 10 and he was 13. Of course, at 13, he really didn't know that she existed. And he actually had a bit of a thing going with Liddy at the time. So it's quite complex.
Yes.
And also, Jed's had a strange background in the time he's been away from the village. His family left the village almost as soon as the accident happened. And he found himself a couple of years later living in a squat, dropped out from society. And that was really interesting. It's surprisingly hard to get back.
Very gritty backdrop. Quite surprising, really, for romantic fiction.
Well, not really. I don't intend to write issue-led books. I don't sit down and think, now, what issue can I write about today? Where is my halo burning most brightly? But my last book had a hero who had a neurological condition. It's just what happens to interest me at the time. I do write about something rather than very little, if you see what I mean. The hero and heroine always have their own quests and conflicts and real issues. But we fall in love against those backgrounds every day of the week, don't we? So that's what my characters do too.
You talk about them like you're telling me a story about people you know, real people. Is that how you feel when you're...
Well, mostly. If you don't know your characters at all, or if you don't know them well enough that you know how they'll react and interact, then I don't think you're going to convince anybody.
So what's your process? Do you start with your characters and go deep into their psyche before you begin to write the story?
I wouldn't say deep, but I do. That is my starting point is I write a biography. And I look at them from different people's points of view, because if you think of a real person, if you think of yourself, your partner will know a different Alex than your parents or your siblings or people you work with. And so I like to look at them from... particularly men, I think the hero, they're always different with their mum than they are with anybody else. So I always like to look at them from their parents' point of view, if indeed their parents are around, because not all of us are fortunate enough to have our parents around, and that applies to my hero and heroine as well. Liddy, in this book, although she's a secondary character, she's pivotal. And she, in a way, was a starting point because I began thinking about a guy who was a friend of mine when I was a teen, and he got acquired head injury through, well, it wasn't a hit and run, he ran out in front of a car, he misjudged something, but, you know, he got head injury. And as, looking back on it, I think he was okay as long as his old buddies were around, but we grew up, and that left him in a kind of a no-man's land. And I know it was difficult for his parents because he was an adult and he could go to the pub and get drunk, but then he couldn't obviously handle that.
Yeah, sure.
So Liddy never goes and gets drunk, but a woman with those kind of issues has her own vulnerabilities, and so her parents and her sister are always very keen that she has boundaries within the village and that she has her dog with her, and when she starts exceeding the boundaries, that's a plot issue all of its own.
Exactly.
And she follows Tamara off to where she shouldn't be following her, and Tamara's left with her then at work, basically, and no car and things like that. So it was very important to me to understand Liddy and how everybody felt about Liddy. So I drew on this background, although I didn't know that family very closely. I knew the brother as well, and I know how it affected him. And his big brother effectively became his little brother.
Yeah.
And so I gave that dynamic to Tamara and Liddy.
That's fascinating stuff. Do you find then, so it's a bit like what Stephen King talks about, doesn't he? He talks about that plot grows out of character
yes.
and situation.
Yes.
That sounds like what
yes.
you're talking about.
Very much so, yes. And I find people's histories are a good place to mine for plot points. That happened definitely with Jed, because I began with this situation where I knew that he'd been Liddy's teenage boyfriend, you know, the one she'd kissed in the cornfields. Mm-hmm. And I knew that he would come back as an adult, and why. And to begin with, I hadn't filled in that blank, but I had quite an overwhelming feeling about him that he had this wariness and not exactly distrust, but he's always on his guard in case what he has is put under threat. And it was really just, I was having a conversation with a retired police officer, and he was talking about homeless young men. And he said that it can be harder for the young men to find a way back to what we like to think of as society, because there aren't the benefits for them and they don't have the option. I'm not suggesting that this is an option that's taken all the time, but it is by some women that if they can have a child, then they by default will be given a house or some kind of accommodation. And that doesn't seem to work for the young men in the same way, is what he told me. And I began to think about this and about a friend of mine who gave her children a very good home and certainly not short of, you know, love or finance, but they still chose to go and live in a squat at 16. And so I kind of, this kind of came to me, and I thought if he'd had a time out of society, then it would explain a lot about him. And that developed really well, that he never took a hot bath for granted. And he liked everything really clean. And it's one of the things that attracts him to Tamara, is she's a yoga teacher and she's a girl who looks after herself. You know, her nails are always nice, her hair is always washed. And he's attracted to that health and cleanliness.
Oh,
and when I
great.
Said this to a friend who's a horror writer, he said, "You sound like he's going to eat her." So, no, that's your kind of book.
Isn't it funny when you talk about different people and they think, "Oh, yeah, I'd love that to happen." But, yeah, that's great. So you find you sort of, as a writer, you're sort of in the process of writing your book and you kind of open yourself up and think, oh, I've had this conversation with this police.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
And then things start to develop.
That one was kind of the other way round, that I was speaking to him. He's a personal friend. He's a neighbour. It just came up. I can't remember how, you know, just sort of over dinner conversation, and something in the back of my mind clicked. And this is, I don't think that Jed is based on a true character, on anybody I know. I'm sure I would have remembered him, frankly. But it has happened to me before that I, in Love and Freedom, I had a minor character called Reuben, and he is fey and wary, and I do know who I based that on. And it was somebody I didn't know very well, but I used to watch him when I was a teenager. It sounds like I stalked everybody I was a teenager with. I've just got a long memory. But he used to look from behind his hair at people as though checking whether he was welcome or not. And he had a gorgeous smile, and I could just see him as a little bit of a victim. And I was writing this book, and it just suddenly came to me, as the heroine in that is called Honor, was walking along the Undercliff Walk, because that's not a book that's set locally, it's set in Brighton and America, that book, and that she would come around the corner and find Rue being bullied. And I thought, that's what's wrong with him. That, well, not wrong, but that's what's defining him. That's what I wasn't getting about him. He's being bullied. And once that fell into place, then...
It clicks.
Yeah, it's rather like counselling. When I worked for University of Leicester, I went to a meeting once and we were on the next table to the counselling tutors. And the writers, the creative writing tutors and the counselling tutors, we dealt with things in exactly the same way. But they did it with real people and we did it with pretend people. Why did he do that? What makes her think this?
Reverse engineering. So you start with a characteristic and then go back to find out why.
Either way.
Or either.
I don't mind. Yeah. I don't mind. I'm not fussy.
As long as it's got some substance. And
yes.
And then it makes sense.
And it clicks. It clicks. Yeah, I do. I like that word substance. I don't like to think my characters are copies or, you know,
stock cutouts.
Yeah, stock characters. Mm. That's right. I like to really think about them.
Yeah, absolutely. Was romantic fiction as a genre something you read growing up? Something that you were attracted to?
Yes, very much. And still, that's where I like. I suppose I like the feeling of falling in love. And this is a nice, safe way to do it. It's vicarious. You can do it in an afternoon and do it again the next day.
So, are you a romantic person? Or do you put all the romance in your books?
Possibly. I haven't actually thought about that very much. I'm very keen on happy endings and people being happy. So from that point of view, I would say so. If you're asking if I provide petals on the pillow and things like that, not so much. To be honest.
I should be asking your partner that, really.
Yeah.
Perhaps we'll do a follow-up. Much hilarity there with Seymour Croft. Talking about romance. Angela, your book, clearly there's a lot of romance in there. Do you read romance?
I read a reasonable amount of romance, but I prefer romantic books with a slight twist. So I really enjoyed Jojo Moyes' Me Before You, and I really, really, really enjoyed Madeline Miller's The Song of Achilles. I think that's
I love that, yeah.
Yeah, one of the most beautiful books about love I think I've ever read.
And very unusual and different, a twist on it. Why did you put the romantic story in? Because that is sort of threaded through, isn't it?
Because it's my life. What triggered me going into the fashion industry in the first place was getting horrifically dumped by by the evil side parting.
Do you know how the evil side parting feels about the book?
No. And perhaps it's best that way.
Yes.
But you wreak revenge just by calling him side parting. I think that's stunning.
I fulfilled all of my fantasies at that one moment by naming him side parting.
But yeah, so that carries the reader through. That's the kind of core of the book, isn't it? And
it
then
is.
the fashion memories are woven around that. Was that how it started when you wrote it, or was it a bit more hodgepodge, as it were?
Well, originally I wrote a column called Confessions of a Fashionista for the Daily Mail Online, which was much more looking very much at the gossip and and that side of the industry, which I did anonymously. And when it came to write the book, I didn't want to just reproduce that. I also didn't want to give a 2D version of the fashion industry, which I think has sort of been done before. And I wanted to talk about me in the fashion industry, in the sense of that I was an ordinary girl and I wasn't a supermodel. I didn't come from like an amazingly rich background or an amazingly privileged background.
You weren't called Muffy, for example.
No, I wasn't called Muffy. Only in my worst dreams.
I love that. Surely no one's called Muffy, but anyway, yes.
Several of the girls, if you go through the back of Vogue and look at the staff writers, you'll see.
Yeah. I'm intrigued by the idea that you were anonymous when you wrote this Daily Mail column. Were you ever outed?
No, not publicly. Not until right towards the end, when it became apparent that the book was going to come out. I drew a line under the columns when the book was launched, because it was then impossible to continue the anonymity. And also I wanted to kind of move forwards and show a different side of the fashion industry. Yeah.
Oh, lots of questions still to ask. I want to ask you about comic writing in particular, but I think it's time for more music.
It is. We've got a change of moods with Kate Bush and Wuthering Heights. Why have you chosen this?
Well, because I really like doing the arms that she does in the video.
Okay. We'll make some room.
Are you going to do that?
Quite possibly. And also it represents my love of books.
There, Wuthering Heights, we've all decided we want to be Kate Bush. Yes. In the past and the present Kate Bush. We've got Angela Clark in the studio, author of Confessions of a Fashionista, and you're going to read something for us now, Angela.
I am. This section is from my second day of working in the fashion industry at the creative industry, at the creative agency Charlie Munro Management, and one of our clients, an important fashion magazine editor, Miss New York, has just come into the office and brought a cake in for her assistant, whose birthday it is. Miss New York lifts the lid of the box with a theatrical flourish. Inside is the most sumptuous cake I've ever seen. 2 feet long, a huge glistening white rectangle decorated with piles of frosted fruits. Safi's name is piped in the centre. It must have cost a fortune. What a lovely thing to do for her assistant. Miss New York cuts everyone a big slice and I pass them round. My fingers sink into the thick icing as I lift the cake to my mouth, close my eyes and savour the sweet goodness. Velvety chocolate sponge and sweet vanilla frosting dance across my tongue. It's the cake of dreams, the best I've ever tasted. I want to dive into the box and eat it all. I'm so ordering one of these for my birthday. I open my eyes to see Miss New York, Safi, Georgina, Cece, and Pandora staring at me in horror. Is there icing on my nose? We don't actually eat the cake. Georgina sounds disgusted. No one eats the cake, adds Pandora. It's calorie kamikaze. Cece turns a funny shade of green. You'd need to run a marathon just to burn off a strawberry, Miss New York frowns. Look, Safi says in a reassuring voice. You can just smell the cake. You what? That way you get all of the benefit and none of the calories. She smiles. All five of them close their eyes, raise their plates up to their noses, and sniff. A bit of icing drips from my finger and splats on the floor. They are sniffing the cake. They are cake sniffers. See, don't you feel better now? Miss New York shows me her glittering teeth as she takes my plate from my hand. Wait, don't! She drops the cake into the bin. Oh, my God! All the girls step forward and do the same. It's a somber religious ceremony where the world's best cake is sacrificed to the rubbish bin god. Georgina picks up the box containing the remaining cake and drops it into the bin as well. I feel like someone stabbed me in the stomach with a spoon. What kind of hell is this, where cake sniffers smell food and throw it away rather than eat it? I fight the urge to scoop the box of beautiful cake from the bin and run screaming from the building. I fight the urge to cry. Forget genetics. My new colleagues are skinny because they sniff food rather than ingest it. I surreptitiously lick the icing off my fingertips and ponder the sanity of an industry populated by cake sniffers. Or rather, the sanity of working in an industry populated by cake sniffers. Have I made a terrible mistake?
What a waste of a cake. Oh. Well, I think we should offer therapy to everyone absolutely listening to that.
I'm almost in tears myself.
It was to you about comic writing. So the book is very funny. That is one of the funny extracts. There aren't many female comic writers, are there? I mean, female and comedy, whenever there's a female comedian, they're always asked about being a woman, and I suppose I'm doing it now. But did you model it on anybody? Did you read any comic books as you were writing?
Did I read any comic books while I was writing? No. I really like the writing style of Catelyn Moran and Grace Dent and a number of the female columnists who seem to have made an easier segue across into comic writing, in the sense that it's more easy to come across. I also enjoy the work of Kathy Letty, and I really like, I don't know, I think the best humour is stuff that appeals to you and is that you understand and that you can associate with, and therefore obviously I find women more funny because I am a woman. So.
And how do you know when what you're writing is funny? Because I mean, I make myself laugh all the time, but you know, I don't think the joy is shared.
We're sitting there laughing to ourselves.
Gets quietly inside.
I don't know when I know when it's funny or not. I hope it is funny, and people tell me that it is, but I don't know. I just kind of hope for the best.
It's definitely got an element of Bridget Jones to it, hasn't it? And I can so see the movie. I hope there's going to be a movie.
Oh yeah,
that would be fantastic. Fingers crossed. Yeah. If anybody's interested, let us know.
Oh well, it's a change of mood now. I went earlier this week to Wising Arts in Bourne and spoke to Gareth Bell Jones, curator there, about the new exhibition Ex Operative, which is all about books, which runs until the 20th of December. I started by asking him to describe the new exhibition.
Well, it's a very exciting exhibition for us to work on. We've invited the independent bookshop that specialises in artists' books in London, Exmox, the Boxship, to curate an exhibition in the space, so the gallery will be functioning as a bookshop for the duration of the exhibition, as well as hosting an exhibition.
And I suppose it's more relevant than ever at this time to question the nature of what a book is, because books, as well as being paper and cardboard, are virtual things these days as well. And is that what this exhibition's about?
It definitely features quite strongly in how Exmox the Boxship operates. The bookshop is a venture by L. Von Braun, who set it up about 3 years ago, and it focuses particularly on independent publishing and artist books, and these are books that wouldn't work digitally and are very much about the tactile nature of them. But also these are books that are published independently and are on very, very short runs, and it really questions the nature of the publication and the book as an artwork in itself, as a separate medium, the same way as sculpture or painting and in this case publishing.
So visitors to Wising would come into the space and effectively see a bookshop.
Yes, a very much an alternative bookshop. We've invited five artists: Adam Burton, Sophie DeMay, Rory Macbeth, Beatrice Olibriata, and Keith Winter, to create what I guess you could describe as bookshelves or support structures for the books. But these aren't ordinary bookshelves. The artists were briefed to create a structure that could support up to 30 publications, and the way that they do that is very much up to them. So there will be five new commissioned artworks in the space.
And will the books themselves be works of art as well?
Yes, many of them are works of art. There will be a huge selection of publications that you can come and view. There will be a catalogue, and everything will be for sale.
Why did you commission those particular artists? What was it about their work?
All of the artists that we've invited have in their practice a relationship to writing in some form. We wanted artists who worked sculpturally as well as working very closely with literature or writing in their practice. We picked out five themes which made the artist's book. The five strands that we picked out were reading and writing, production, performance, distribution and exchange. And each of the five artists we felt had an affinity with one of those.
And is it interactive?
In as much as anyone can pick up a book and read it in the space, very much so, yes. We're hoping that as well as an exhibition and a functioning bookshop, we're also considering it as a reading room as well. The commission by Sophie DeMay will be a seating structure that we're hoping people will be able to sit in and enjoy reading the books in the space. There'll be a record player with artist records there available for people to play themselves. And we're trying to make the space as comfortable as possible for people to come in and just enjoy.
And why did you feel the need to have an exhibition about books and bookshops? Because I suppose Wising Arts Centre, we associate you more with the visual arts rather than publishing and books.
We wanted to emphasise how much we believe this actually is a part of the visual arts, an important aspect of it. The works, the publications in particular in this show, function visually as well as literary. Most artists that we've worked with have a very, very strong relationship in their practice to writing. Either they practice it themselves or they're very heavily influenced by literature. For instance, one of the artists that we've got in residence at the moment, Michael Dean, is using the time that he's here to focus on his writing. His work, although it may appear formal in some respects, is very, very, very heavily indebted to his writing. And during the course of his residency, he's creating a new body of writing which will come out as one of the events for this exhibition. He'll be creating a new performance for it, which will be very, very exciting.
And do you have a writer in residence here?
We are inviting a writer, Rebecca Jargo, to come for the duration of the exhibition. And she'll be writing and she'll be in the space reading as well, hopefully interacting with anyone coming to the show.
So on the 14th of December you have an event?
Yes, the 14th is very exciting. We've got a group of different artists all launching different publications. It's very much tied into the way that X Marks the Boxship operates, in artists having their space to be able to perform their books or to bring it out and to show how the book exists off the written page and how the writing exists, how it can be performed.
The one that's particularly interesting is The Wanderer by Franz Kafka, because that's an audio piece. Mm-hmm. So what will visitors to Wising experience if they came to see that or hear that?
A recital of this fantastic book, The Wanderer by Franz Kafka. That's the title of the book, and that's by Rory Macbeth. Rory rewrote The Wanderer by reading the German edition of this text without understanding German. So he's rewritten the book as he understands it, and so it's very much Rory's work.
Do you think this might be something that Wising will go back to and explore?
I think it's something which we will always explore. We have very strong links with literature and also with music, with our annual music festival. And artists, particularly the artists that we work with, are always pushing the margins of the visual arts. And often you get a blurred area between art practice and writing and music. And it's interesting to look into these grey areas and what fits in between medium. And that's often the place where very, very interesting activity takes place, particularly what's happening at X Marks the Boxship. We felt it was very, very important that an institution showcased this area. And sometimes things aren't as clear as this being writing and literature and this being art practice. Sometimes things fit in between and aren't quite easily defined as being one or the other. And I think this is a perfect example of that.
That was Gareth Bell-Jones, their curator at Wising Arts in Bourne. Gareth was very down to earth there, very easy to understand talking about art, because there can be a lot of jargon associated around things like that, as with the fashion industry. Reading your book, I mean, designer names and terminology thrown around with gay abandon, did you find that?
It was quite shocking, actually. Having been in the industry for such a long time, I forgot that normal people don't know what you're talking about. So every now and then I'd have these little marks from my editor going, I think you ought to explain what Spanx is. No, everybody knows what Spanx is. And no, I think you ought to explain what Spanx is. Okay, I think you ought to explain what tear sheeting is, which is when you take magazine pages that a photographer's taken, for example, and put them in their portfolio. And all this kind of thing's coming along. So we didn't go as far as a glossary. We managed to avoid that. But hopefully it makes sense for the uninitiated.
So when you start out in the book and you're sort of the wide-eyed and innocent, and there's the girls who know everything about fashion and are sort of, you know, looking down on you, but you spent 10 years in that industry, so have you, did it change you?
Oh yes, it changed my bank balance to a great detriment. It changed my wardrobe and the way that I look. I have a great photo of before I went to the fashion industry wearing a lavender
fleece,
yes, yeah. Like a fleece, and then like stonewashed jeans, like mum jeans, and a little grey rucksack, and I have mousy hair and glasses, and all of that's been removed somewhat surgically.
Do you find yourself looking at people, I mean, you make fun of it, and it, you know, there's a bad side of it, but you can't help but be changed to become more sophisticated in fashion terms. So, you know, if you take on a little bit of the Pandora's persona, in that she's sort of, oh, where do you get those shoes?
I do visually take people apart, it is true.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah. I'm feeling very conscious of my Primark top. I don't think it cuts
Primani.
It to me.
Primani.
Yeah. So what period of time were you writing about?
It was before the recession, so it's sort of the 2000s pretty much from start to finish, before everything imploded. So it's a time when we were all living quite happily on our credit cards, spending loads and not really worrying about it. And I think it's quite interesting to look back at that and look at the sort of the materialism and the commercial focus that not just those in the fashion industry had, but everybody did.
And do you think the fashion industry has changed since then?
I think it has changed, but I think it's more to do with other things. Obviously, their bread and butter is to sell you stuff, and there are still plenty of people that they can sell really beautiful, expensive items to. I don't see a huge nod towards austerity in the fashion industry. I don't think they're terribly interested in it. But I think that the industry has changed in the sense that it is slowly becoming more responsible, with things like the All Walks campaign to get diversity on the catwalk, and into mainstream advertising, and also because of technology, things like the fashion bloggers has literally changed the landscape of things like London Fashion Week. The bloggers have become such a big part of it. It used to be, when you rocked up to London Fashion Week, it was the same 30 people, the same 30 editors, all dressed in black, who had the tickets, all smoking on the sidelines. Now there are hundreds and hundreds of street-style people trying to get their photographs onto blogs and things like that, and it's become a real sort of performance piece to see. And I think those 30 editors who dominated it, wearing all in black, a bit peeved, actually.
That's good to know. Should we have some more music now? Your last track that you've chosen is Dolly Parton, 9 to 5. Why have you chosen this?
Because she's Dolly Parton, she's amazing, even for nothing else, for when she said, I'm never offended by blonde jokes, dumb blonde jokes, because I know I'm not dumb and I know I'm not blonde.
Out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping, out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving, they just use your mind. Give you credit. step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. In the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in, and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. Looking 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and you never get the credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5, yeah, they got you where they want you. There's a better life and you think about it, don't you? It's a rich man's game. What they call it, and you spend your life putting money in his wallet. 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5, yeah, they got you where they want you.
Welcome back to Bookmark with our studio guest, Angela Clark. Angela, a different subject now. On your blog, you talk a lot about your illness, EDS3. What is that?
It's Ehlers-Danlos, and it's a rare genetic condition that affects the collagen in your body. I have faulty collagen, basically. It's too stretchy, but it's multi-systemic, so it affects your muscles, your joints, your breathing, your blood flow, everything. It's really not recommended to get.
Now, without prying too much, how does it affect you on a daily level?
Well, on a daily level, it's easier to talk about lifestyle management, I guess. I go to the physio 2 or 3 times a week to keep me ticking over. Earlier this year in April, unfortunately, I had a bad flare-up of my EDS, which basically saw me incapacitated for 3 weeks. I got back from, recovered from that by about September, in terms of my strength and being able to write. I'm now up to approaching something like I can use a keyboard 4 or 5 hours a day. So it's kind of a continual process.
So it affects your writing?
It does, unfortunately, it does, yeah. I'm having to relearn how to write, in the sense that I beforehand would write for hours. That's how I would get my book done. I would just sit and write for 14 hours until it was right, until it was perfect, which I think a lot of people with a lot of time do. A lot of writers do that. You just keep going at it. I'm now having to learn how to work smarter rather than longer. And so I'm having to retrain myself so that the words that come out are a lot more concise and a lot more correct first time, because I just don't have enough juice in the tank to write for that length of time anymore.
And you wrote about it on your blog. Why did you decide to be public about it?
Because it is quite a rare condition. And I think it would be useful if more people knew about it, just so when I get on a bus and I can't get up when I ring the bell and the man starts shouting at me, going, "Are you going to get off or not?" I don't have to lie and say, "Oh, sorry, I've got arthritis." Because if I say, "Oh, I've got EDS3, he has no idea what I'm talking about. So to raise awareness, and also because for, unfortunately, large chunks of my life, it's pretty much the only thing on my mind.
How did the fashion industry cope with you having an illness like that?
Well, I was actually diagnosed after I left the industry.
Oh, really?
Though complications had started to appear before I left. So towards the very end, I couldn't wear high heels anymore because I found it impossible to walk in them and impossible to stand in them. And my high-heeled days may be over completely now. In fact, a lot of the time I have a walking stick. But it was difficult because I didn't know what was wrong, so it looked like I was making a big fuss over nothing when you just sort of suck it up and put your feet in heels and get on with it. And people would ask me all the time, they would sort of look down at me and say, what are you doing down there? Why aren't you dressed properly? Because, of course, you know, properly is high heels.
High heels.
Especially at social events for fashion.
Wow. It's just as well you got out, I think, isn't it, really? And so you're writing life now. Are you working on another book?
I am. I am working on another book. And I can't say much about
okay.
it.
But
it's top going.
Secret. Oh, that's
top
very
secret.
Exciting.
But it's going to be a fiction book.
And you're blogging and you're... I noticed on your blog as well you were talking about running a Twitter competition, so you're one of these writers that know how to use the writer's platform. That's the new thing. So you're very happy doing all of that sort of thing.
Brand Ange.
Yeah.
I think that the publishing industry is very tough. There are about 2,000 books that are published every week at the moment, and in order for you to stand out, you have to do everything within your power to kind of jump up and down and draw attention to yourself, whether that's running a Twitter campaign or writing a journalism piece or appearing on a radio show. Then it's sort of your duty, if you want people to discover about your books, that's what you have to do.
And you have a very active relationship with your readers, I suppose, which is nice too.
Well, it's actually great, actually. I really enjoy that aspect of it. I love Twitter in that sense. I love it when people contact me and said, oh, I've read your book, especially young people. It's really, really, yeah. really nice. And I really loved it, and it's inspired me to either go into the fashion industry or not go into the fashion industry, or to write or not to write. And it's I really enjoy that aspect of it. It's really fulfilling, actually, very fulfilling.
And you were saying at your fair that you were giving a careers talk at a school. Do you advise people to go into the fashion industry?
I advise people to go into the fashion industry, but to make sure that they keep their high heels on the floor. There are a large number of really wonderful, really down-to-earth people who work in the fashion industry who are able to exist in such a sort of intense and insane environment and retain all their smarts. I wasn't one of those people. I disappeared up my Spanx clad bottom. And so I would say yes, go into it. It's fantastic. It's a really energetic, really creative, really inspiring place within which to work. You have a lot of fun, a lot of freebies. That's always really
yeah,
great.
But
make sure that you don't forget what really matters, which is, you know, friends, family, and not in your handbag.
Keep your eyes open, basically.
Absolutely.
And are you still in touch with the people in the fashion industry? Is it still a world that you kind of have a finger in?
Yeah, I have. That sounds very rude. I am
sorry. Yes, it does. As soon as I said it, I realised. I thought it could pass unnoticed.
Oh, dear me.
Moving on.
Fingers in many lies. I am. I have a number of good friends still from my time in the fashion industry. So I still keep. One high heel in every now and then.
That's a much better metaphor,
yes,
isn't it?
It is. You haven't burnt your bridges, basically. That's good, yeah. Or your Spanx.
Yep.
Thanks very much, Angela. It's been brilliant to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
With the book. It's a great book, really funny. So please go out and buy it. Our next show is all about kids.
Well, it's our Christmas show, really, isn't it? It goes out on the 14th of December.
Can we play some Christmas music?
Oh, please no. Please no. So we're a bit goo, yes. It's children's fiction. So
yes.
Our studio guest is children's writer Tony Mitten, although he does write for adults as well, and we can talk to him about his grown-up writing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got an interview with Michael Catchpool, who's a children's author and also a head teacher.
We have to call him Mr. Catchpool, really,
because
he is a head teacher. And we've got some guest interviewers on that one. We've got...
Who may or may not be related to us.
No.
Nepotism is alive and well.
Mia, Grace and Joe. I nearly forgot the name of my own child there. Anyway. So
and we've got, is it another interview with...
Oh, Greg Gormley. The lovely Greg Gormley is also on that show talking about his picture books. And he actually moved over from illustrating to writing picture books. So that was quite an interesting one. So, yeah, that's the next show.
So join us then. Until then, as usual, this is your catchphrase. Let's say it all together now. Alex, come on, say it with me.
Okay, then.
Enjoy your books.